roughly 600,000 people are reported missing each year, according to the National Missing and Unidentified Missing Persons System. Right now in Pennsylvania, there are about 400 open cases. Lawmakers are trying to get the Pennsylvania governor to sign House Bill 930, which would require Pennsylvania State Police to relinquish DNA samples of missing and unidentified persons, but it would also provide counseling and status updates to families. Now, at the time that I outlined this episode, it was January 23rd. It is now February 12th. I didn't check to see the progression, but I believe just in doing some other reading that it maybe has progressed into law, but I don't know. Incidentally, though, the man that we will be focusing on today in our missing persons episode is former Center County District Attorney Ray Frank Grecar. And Ray Grecar was born on October 9th, 1945 in Cleveland, Ohio. Always our connection to Ohio, right? He attended the Gilmore Academy in Gates Mills before attending University of Dayton. Go Flyers, am I right? And interning in the prosecutor's office. He was like, oh man, I like this. So after graduation, he studied law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Imagine that on a hoodie. It's a lot. Ray's wife, Barbara Gray, whom he met at UD, was offered a position at Penn State, and in 1980, they moved to State College, Pennsylvania. He was kind of staying at home and raising their daughter, Laura, until he was offered a part-time position in the DA's office, and in 1985, he ran for the open DA position and remained there part-time until 1996, after which he would remain as full-time DA, until he decided in 2004 he wasn't going to run again, and he was planning to retire on January 1st, 2006, shortly after his 60th birthday. On April 15th, 2005, Ray was like, you know what? I'm not feeling it today. I'm going to play a little hooky from work. He had been living with Patty Fornicola. She was a clerk at the Center County Courthouse, and they had been living together, I believe, for about 3 years. They shared her childhood home in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, and according to Patty on that day, she gets up, leaves him a glass of orange juice, heads on into work, and she was filling in as the receptionist that morning. At around 11:30, she answers the courthouse phone, and it's Ray. And according to Patty, Ray seems a little bit startled that she was the one to answer, but he tells her, like, hey, I'm out driving on Route 192, just taking a leisurely drive, but I won't make it back to take care of Honey, their dog, because Patty says that she had left him a note about Honey, like, hey, let me know if you can take care of the dog when you get up or whatever. Patty goes home from work. Ray isn't back yet, but she's not concerned because it's still pretty early, and she heads off to the local YMCA to get a workout in. When she returns 2 hours later, there's still no Ray. She starts calling and repeatedly gets voicemail. So around 8 o'clock that evening, she calls 911 and reports him missing. In the morning, she calls Ray's daughter, who lives in Washington State, and tells her, like, hey, your dad hasn't come home. You know, they both know that that's pretty unlike him. And Laura says that she had spoken with Ray the night before he went on his drive and recalled that there was nothing unusual about the conversation. They spoke pretty frequently every couple of days or so. Because this was the county's DA, they skipped all of the usual missing persons protocols and waiting periods and immediately, you know, sent out their forces. An aerial search along Route 192 begins, and they are looking for Ray's 2004 white top red Mini Cooper because they start thinking, okay, there's been an accident. You know, he's stranded in his car, but they come up with nothing. Around 6:30 p.m. on April 16th, they spot a red Mini parked on Water Street in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, which was about 50 miles away from Bellefonte. It's located in a lot across from an antique mall called Street of Shops. They approach the car and they see that there are no keys in the vehicle. However, there are cigarette ashes in the passenger side floorboard, and the car smelled, some sources say heavily, some say faintly. I don't know, but either way, there was a smell of cigarette smoke, you know, pretty distinct. Everybody could smell it. And everyone in Ray's life is adamant that he was not a smoker and never let anyone light up in his car. Like, that was one of the biggest things, is people were like, it smells like smoke in here. That's the strangest thing. And inside the vehicle was also his county-issued cell phone. It was powered off. Prints were taken from inside the vehicle and on the phone, but there weren't enough characteristics to identify them. And they also found multiple cigarette butts on the ground near the passenger side of the vehicle. And those were also collected and tested, but there wasn't any match to anyone in any law enforcement databases. Exterior prints were taken from the vehicle, and those were identified as Ray's. Witnesses say that he was seen talking to a thin, dark-haired woman in her 30s or 40s in the antique mall. But unfortunately, there was really no way of locating this mystery woman because of the time that had lapsed before they started either getting these reports or looking into them seriously. So nothing really ever came of that. Located across the road from Street of Shop stands the Packwood House Museum in Lewisburg. And this museum shop was originally constructed as a two-story log cabin between 1796 and 1799, and it was used as an inn and tavern for travelers along the Susquehanna River. It evolved and became a hotel called the American House, and eventually a married couple, Edith and John Featherston, I think that's how you say that, founded the Packwood House, and they named it after a family home in England. They didn't have any kids, so when they passed on, they left it in the wills to turn the house into a public museum for the, quote, educational benefit of all persons. This is really not relevant to our case at all, but I'm a big fan of museums, like historical societies, like old shit. That is my jam, especially if it's named after a family home in England. So I wanted to include because the pictures of this place are like super dope, and I wanted you to know that if you are in Pennsylvania, maybe check it out. All of their website says that it's closed right now, but when it reopens, it holds Edith's garden from the 1930s, and it is the only collection of Japanese cedar trees in the area. And I thought that it was really cool, and the pictures are cool. So anyway, employees at the museum report seeing Ray's car parked across the street, not in the Street of Shops lot. It was just parked along the road on the side of the street opposite the museum. Like there's a few parking spaces painted on the road there, and they saw him getting in and out of his car, like multiple times. Like he would get in and then get out and then get back in as if he was waiting for someone. Around 5:30 p.m., two witnesses say that they see Ray moving his car into the Street of Shops, and canines do pick up his scent in the parking lot, but nowhere further. Ray's ex-wife confirmed that once before, he was in need of a little break, and he just took off to Cleveland to attend a Guardians game, formerly known as the Cleveland, Indians. And then, like, just poof, he was back at work on Monday. He didn't tell anyone that he was going, according to her. He just, like, took off for the weekend, went to a game, and went back to work. So people think, okay, maybe he's just taking another one of his little breaks. Like, maybe he's going antiquing. He and Patty really like to visit antique shops. In fact, part of his retirement plan was to drive around the country with Patty, just going to antique shops, which sounds awesome, honestly. In the days following his disappearance, a court administrator made a comment that Ray had been, quote, withdrawn recently, and other coworkers say that he was unusually chipper in the days leading up to his disappearance. Patty says that Ray was napping frequently, and about 2 weeks before his disappearance, he would come home on his lunch breaks to nap and then still take a nap after work. So this was really unusual behavior for him, according to her. And since it had never occurred in the 3 years prior, she asked him to go get a checkup. Police did subpoena medical records, but no major issues or reference to depression was found. This, of course, doesn't mean that he didn't have something else medically going on, or even that, you know, he wasn't depressed just because these records didn't say. On April 14th, Ray had taken half a day off work and was seen around between 10:30 to 11 a.m. at a marina, possibly at Raystown Lake. I couldn't find the exact marina, but just doing a little bit of searching, and I actually asked some people on TikTok, and a local girl helped me kind of narrow some things down. So maybe there. He enters the courthouse that day wearing casual clothes like t-shirts and a pair of jeans, and CCTV footage picks him up entering at 6:19 p.m. and then he exits at 8:07 p.m. So it's like he's there for a little bit longer than just running in to like grab something, but he's dressed so casually and he's there so late in the evening. Nobody really knows what he was doing. After he went missing, authorities ask Patty to turn in his county-issued laptop. So she goes to grab it out of the laptop bag, which I believe they kept in a closet somewhere, and it's not there. And according to Patty, prior to his disappearance, Ray had purchased hard drive erasing software. So the question is, you know, is this because he wanted to remove personal information before returning the laptop? You know, because his pending retirement, perhaps, I think that's logical. But a lot of people think that he was trying to remove maybe something a little more disturbing. On April 18th, the FBI gets on board. Now, they conduct a financial analysis, and there are apparently no red flags. Now, I don't have access to the findings of that analysis, so I could be way out of pocket here, but I do have a couple of things to say about this. This man was the district attorney. He had been in office since 1985. The district attorney's salary at the time of his disappearance was about $130,000. He lived with Patty in her modest childhood home in Bellefonte, and his Mini Cooper was reportedly in her name. He had about $100,000 untouched in his bank account. So, like, where's the rest of your money going? That is my question. Was he investing it somewhere? Did that come up in their analysis? Like, I would like to get my hands on that because, I mean, I'm poor, okay? But I'm pretty decent at managing my finances. And my brain instantly is like, $100,000 in savings, living a modest life. Where's your money at? Antiques? Plausible. Like I said, they like to go antiquing. Antiques are expensive. I don't know if you guys have ever like stepped foot into a quaint little town antique shop, but could be. So anyway, I just wanted to put that into your minds. Like, huh? Where's all your money going? During an analysis of Ray's work computer, they found someone, presumably him, map-quested directions from Bellefonte to Lewisburg. People were baffled by this because he made that drive many times. So there's no reason that he should have been map-questing it, but it was on his work computer. So on July 30th, Ray's laptop was found in the Susquehanna River by two fishermen close to the bridge nearby where his vehicle was parked, and the hard drive was missing from the laptop. On August 8th, at a restaurant in Texas, I think it was a woman, I don't know if it was a woman or a man, a restaurant patron took pictures of a man that looked so much like Ray. She was like, or he, I think it was a woman. I'm just going to say she. I don't know why I focus on this stuff. I don't know why you guys listen to this podcast. This person took pictures of this man with her cell phone, his cell phone, their cell phone, because they saw a man who looked so much like Ray. Got it? Did I convey that? Okay, cool. FBI facial recognition analysis was done, and they determined that this man was not Ray. On October 1st, a hard drive was found by two people skipping rocks about 100 yards away from where the laptop was found, behind the street of shops. The division of the CIA did the analysis, and nothing was found. But the people who analyzed Space Shuttle Columbia, if you don't know, because I did not, because space terrifies me. Columbia was the US's first reusable shuttle, and it had completed about 27 missions without incident until February 1st, 2003, a piece of foam flew off during launch. And there's like video evidence of this. You can see it like pop off. And NASA was like, oh boy, we should take pics of this in case something bad happens. But officials were like, nah, couldn't be us. We're NASA. And on its reentry, something bad did happen. The Columbia disintegrated over Texas minutes before it was supposed to return to Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and it killed all seven astronauts inside. So that was really depressing that I learned about while I was researching this, and another reason that I don't like space. But anyway, the people who analyzed that also did an analysis of the hard drive, and they didn't find anything either. Weird. The river had previously been searched for any sign of Ray because very early on it was decided that he likely committed suicide. No sign of Ray has ever been identified in this river. There is an area near the dam where water like churns pretty crazily, and you know, it could demolish a body, but again, I'm clueless. I don't know. I don't work in the medical field. I don't work with deceased bodies. I don't know anything. But my question is, bones? Would it crush up bones? Like, water is, here's my list of fears. Vomit, space, water. In that order. I really like water, like being on the water. But the older I get, and I believe I said this before in other episodes, the older I get, the more terrifying it becomes to me. That doesn't matter about what we're talking about. So I just wanted to say water is scary, and maybe it could crush our bones. I don't know. If any of you know, feel free. Please let me know. I'm just saying, at some point, somewhere, a piece of Ray should have been located if he was in this river. That's what I think. Meanwhile, Patty's house was searched. There was no blood, no signs of foul play. Because some people were like, hey, Patty, you were the last person to see Ray alive, as far as we know, or to see Ray, I should say. What were you doing? So she did submit in July of 2005 to a 3.5 hour long polygraph test, and it was administered by the Secret Service. But she passed, and Ray's daughter also took and passed a polygraph. No one else was given a polygraph or considered a suspect. Not to say that Patty or Laura were considered suspects, but they were closer to the investigation than anyone else. In 2007, police receive a report of a sighting. I'm so sorry. I don't mean to laugh. I don't know why I laugh so often. I have a nervous laugh. They report a sighting of a man who looks like Ray at the taping of the Oprah Winfrey Show. And the reason I'm chuckling is because, like, if you wanted to start a new life and hide away from anyone who might know you, and you were the friggin' DA, why would you go? Why would you go to that? Why would you go to the taping of an Oprah Winfrey Show? Please. Anyway, nothing came of that either. So on April 15th, 2009, Detective Matt Unser, with the Bellefonte Police Department advises the home computer showed searches of, quote, how to wreck a hard drive and also water damage to a notebook computer. So, interesting. Why did people assume so quickly that Ray ended his life? Well, in May of 1996, after retiring from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ray's brother, 53-year-old Roy Grecar, said he was going to go buy some mulch. 2 days later, his car was found at a Dayton park near the Great Miami River. Later, his body was pulled from the river and his death was ruled suicide by drowning. Roy had reportedly suffered from depression and bipolar disorder for many years leading up to his death. But I read this little article written by a former classmate of Roy's, the author. His name is Tom Ashley, and I'm saying that because it's you can find it on the interweb. So he posted it with his real name. I assume it's his real name. Anyway, Tom Ashley was in charge of Turner Broadcasting's advertising sales division for a decade, like CNN and Turner Classic Movies. And then it merged with Time Warner. And he also created these vignettes, This Day In. Whatever year. So it'd be like, This Day In 1987. And those ran from 1988 to 1995. I just found that interesting. It doesn't matter. Anywho, Tom explains that while not close to Roy at their prep school, again, the Gilmore Academy, they had a nice evening chatting at a 35th reunion. They exchanged cards at the end of the night, and about a year later, Roy calls up Mr. Ashley and says, hey, I'm going to be in London next week. Tom and his girlfriend lived in a flat in London, and they have Roy and his wife come over for dinner. And it's during that evening that Tom says Roy tells him about some concerns he has with his job as a civilian approval expenditure manager. Tom claims that Roy explained a new contract for the maintenance of Air Force jet engine cargo planes was way less strict than previous, more costly contracts. In this contract, service engineers were not required to remove the engine to check bolts and, general safety of a freaking jet engine. They could just, take a cruise now on the service platform. This is, basically a ladder with a balcony, those little things that you can, zoom around on. They can take one of those service platforms up and just inspect everything, test the bolts. They don't have to take anything apart. Roy says, Well, this is bonkers because, yeah, I don't even, I'm a regular civilian, and I agree, Roy. He filed a report saying as much and would not sign off on the contract. According to Roy, a jet went down shortly after and killed all the crew members. When going back to check his maintenance orders and recommendations, poof, they were gone, along with his computer. Everything was just missing. Roy says that he tried to tell the commanding officer about the crash, but nobody would talk to him about it. Roy tells Tom that he's a mess and he feels like he's in danger and determined that it wouldn't be safe to tell the authorities. He asks Tom what he should do, and Tom tells Roy about two producers he knows at Public Broadcasting's NewsHour and CBS's 60 Minutes and offers to call them for him. Roy's like, I'll get back to you on that. A year later, Tom gets a call that Roy had jumped off a bridge. When Tom called Roy's wife to offer his condolences, he shares everything that I just told you about with her and everything, you know, all of his suspicions and whatnot. And Roy's wife tells Tom, like, that's not true. He was super depressed. He had lost his job, didn't know how to go on. So the question is, like, did his computer really go missing? In the piece, Tom seems to think that the connection between the two computers is the information that Roy was sharing and perhaps shared it with Ray. Either way, his family thinks that the similarities are eerie. In 2015, construction of a 12-mile central Susquehanna Valley Thruway Bridge began. Its completion is scheduled for 2027, but nearly a mile of this was completed in 2020. One would think that if Ray's body had been in this river, there would have been, you know, an inkling in the last 15 years, but nope. Not even when they have been doing all this work. Like, just nothing of Ray has ever shown in that river, except for his laptop. Now, Ray pissed off a lot of people during his career. I think that's inevitable if you are a DA. And in June of 1996, 26-year-old Donald Grove shot and killed 25-year-old religious DJ. And I tried so hard to find the pronunciation of his name, and I can't, and I'm sorry because I'm sure I'm saying it wrong, but I believe it's Kitu. It's K-I-T-U. Samson, his last name was Samson. He entered a Knob Hill trailer owned by Grove, and Grove didn't live in the trailer at this time, but Samson's wife, and I typically don't like to refer to victims by their last name, but since I am surely saying it wrong, I'm just going to call him Samson from here on out. Samson's wife had been staying at a women's shelter and stored some of her personal items in the trailer. Samson entered the trailer on more than one occasion to retrieve his wife's items, and on the third time, according to Grove, he warned him to get out, and Samson didn't listen, so he shot him. Regarding the crime, Ray says, I am convinced that there is sufficient evidence to justify the filing of charges, and I've instructed investigator Mulfinger to do that. I think a reasonable jury or judge could find Mr. Grove guilty of all these charges, including first-degree murder. But once the case went to trial, Samson's father, Reverend Shelley Samson, said he was, quote, infuriated at Ray's opening statements. Shelley says that Ray did not focus on the fact that Grove wasn't living in the trailer and focused too much on his son's past domestic issues with his wife. There had previously been a request to move the trial to a different location because Ferguson Township Police Chief Edward Connor told the press it was a justifiable homicide. Samson's mother, I believe it's DeLoronzo, I'm sorry, Mrs. Samson, had this to say about Ray. He was totally disregarded. He has, excuse me, totally disregarded us altogether. I am not mad yet. I don't hate them yet, but I am moving big time towards it. Samson's family was so upset by Ray's opening argument, they left the courtroom about a half an hour into the trial, calling Ray unethical and out of line. Lori, which was Samson's wife, testified that Grove said he wanted revenge after one of the prior break-ins. Ultimately, the jury found Grove not guilty. In 2013, there was a tip from former Hell's Angel member saying that Ray was killed in retaliation for handing down a hefty prison sentence. Now, the former member says that he knows this because he is the one who ordered the hit, and he could even tell you where the body is in exchange for a shorter prison sentence, because duh. Another Ohio connection is Mel Wiley. Mel was the police chief of Medina County, and in 1985, he said that he was going to go take a swim in Lake Erie with a friend, but 3 days later, his car was found at Edgewater Park, and he was not in the car. His clothes, police ID, and some cash were, but not him or his body, and he's never been found. He liked to write mystery novels when he wasn't policing, so some theorize that he walked away to start a new life. And the reason I'm telling you this is because a lot of people speculate that Ray was doing the same thing. So, they kind of look between the similarities of these two. Other people have speculated that he is in the witness protection program. The problem there is I don't believe that prosecutors are eligible to be placed into that program. I truly don't know. So if there are any law professionals listening to this by chance, please feel free to send in your feedback or leave it on the socials. I did give it a cursory read, like just some law articles and US government sites, but I couldn't find exactly what I was looking for. And I also get nervous sometimes about my Google searches, so I didn't spend too much time on that. In 2014, Pennsylvania State Police finally took over the case, and it's still open. Like, there's really no. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what happened to him. Nothing has ever come up after the laptop. Like, there's just no sign at all of Ray Grecar. But going back to 2011, Dateline, you know who, they were at the Street of Shops and they were getting some images, like some shots of the area for their piece about Ray. And this woman named Ivy Butterworth, and I promise you, I was like, is this like a made up? Is this to protect identity? But I think this is really her name. And she said, "Oh, hey, I saw Ray that day. I didn't think it was important to tell anyone." And in my notes, I put three question marks. I don't know how to translate that to you verbally, but it's kind of like this. That's what I do when I'm typing, and I put three question marks. So anyway, on April 15th, 2005, Ivy says that she was out jogging and she noticed a Mini Cooper because she likes cars and the Minis weren't like hugely popular in that area yet. So she thinks, oh, cute car. And she notices a man and a woman inside the parked car. This is what she's quoted as saying in the Daily Item article. So this is Ivy Butterworth. I knew the man I saw was a Gree car. The abandoned car was the car that I saw, and there was definitely a woman in the car. I never said anything to anybody because, well, what's the point? I mean, the guy was never found. If he wants to run off and go to Mexico or wherever with his girlfriend and he's got the money to do it, hey, I wish it was me. Again. She goes on to say that the Dateline interviewer asked her again, why didn't you say anything at the time? And Ivy says, it wouldn't have changed anything. It wouldn't have helped or hindered their investigation in any way. I thought he was still going. In my personal opinion, this was all very well thought out, very well planned, and he's living a happy life somewhere. So, was he with a woman? Like, was she blonde? Was she dark haired? Because in a lot of articles, it's vaguely mentioned that Ray was some sort of like ladies' man. And people say they saw him with a blonde girl that day, but then they say the dark haired woman inside the antique mall. Just a lot of references to like Ray and being some type of like womanizer. But Ray seemed to lead a pretty private personal life. So, if he was some sort of philanderer, I don't know. There's no supporting evidence of that yet that I've seen. If you look into this case, you'll just see that people say that he was like, meeting women online and stuff like that, but there's no real substance to that, as far as I could tell. Now, in 1998, Ray decided not to indict Jerry Sandusky, who was the then athletic director for Penn State and later charged with multiple sexual misconduct charges of young boys, some between the ages of 8 to 12, over the course of like 15 years. All right. In 2012, so 1998 is when Ray said, nah, I'm not even, We're not going to look into this. 2012 is when Jerry Sandusky was sentenced to 60 years in prison because he absolutely was doing some bad stuff, 30 which he has to serve to be eligible for parole. I'm not going to get into much detail here because sometimes I can only take so much abuse against children. And this is so well known. But if you're not familiar with it, there is inexhaustible resources online for you to read about it. Now, some people are like, it was really just about money. It was about extortion. You know, there's lots and lots of stuff that you can read about. Personally, I'm not going to tell you what I feel personally because it doesn't matter. Penn State as a whole can eat my entire butt. That's pretty much how I feel. Okay, we'll leave it at that. If you think that sounds harsh, then I suggest going to do some of that reading that I just talked about. Some believe that Ray's death could have been linked to his refusal to prosecute so many years before. And season one, episode 15, I think it was, because it got erased in my notes, of Blacklist is supposed to be based upon Ray and Jerry. But don't know, can't confirm, because Blacklist scares the poop out of me. I don't watch it. I know that sounds wild because of the material that I share with you guys, but you will never catch me watching Blacklist, okay? While researching this case, you will also find references to Jonathan Luna. Jonathan was a 38-year-old assistant U.S. attorney in Baltimore, Maryland, and on December 3rd, 2003, he was at the federal courthouse working on a plea agreement for two men accused of running heroin through their recording studio. They had a startup music label called, fittingly, Stash House Records. Around 11 p.m., he gets a phone call and tells his wife that he's got to run to the office. She doesn't know who called, and Jonathan heads out. His car is captured leaving the courthouse at 11:38 p.m., but he left behind his glasses and his cell phone. Seems like two things you would probably want to have late at night, especially if you were going to drive from Baltimore to Philadelphia. That's where investigators believe that he was heading. But at 5:30 a.m. on December 4th, a Sensening and Weaver employee said, "Hey, there's this car I've never seen before on our company property, and it's just sitting there idling." So he and a coworker go down, and they discover that Jonathan Luna's body was face down in a creek off of Dry Tavern Road in Lancaster County. He had been stabbed 36 times and beaten with injuries to his genitals as well. Investigators find that he had stopped at an ATM to withdraw $200 at JFK Plaza in Delaware, and he later stopped at a gas station to fill up and buy snacks. Seemed perfectly calm, according to witnesses, but something odd is that his car was equipped with Easy Pass. That's like a electronic toll booth collection system. I think probably a lot of people are familiar, but I, a country bumpkin, was not until several years ago. So you get this sticker that goes on your vehicle or like your license plate, and you're recorded entering and exiting the booths. And then the toll is deducted from your account. So it's just a lot quicker. You don't have to stop and get the little tickets and stuff. So he has Easy Pass, but at Pennsylvania Turnpike exit 359, a little bit before 3 a.m., Jonathan got a paper ticket instead of going through the Easy Pass lane. At exit 286, around 4 a.m., a paper ticket was given to the attendant with blood spots on it. Before his death, Jonathan was prosecuting a pornography case that was called by the office, quote, one of the most significant prosecutions of 2003. But in the months leading up, lawyers working with him said he was acting disorganized and distracted. Other sources say Jonathan was expressing concerns that he was about to be fired. Coworkers talk about how a relatively new boss, Thomas DiBiagio, my best attempt, he made it quite clear that he didn't like Jonathan at all. But court officials deny this and they're like, nope, not a problem. He had a performance review shortly before his death. No concerns. Like, everything was fine. Other reports say that he had adult pornography on his federal issued laptop that was not related to the case he was trying. In 2002, a bank robbery case prosecuted by Jonathan resulted in about $36,000 going missing. It had been used as evidence in the trial, but somehow between the trial ending and the evidence storage area, it just disappeared. Now, around that time, Jonathan allegedly applied for a loan application of approximately $30,000, but shortly after the evidence money went missing, his application was canceled. Authorities say he had credit cards that his wife didn't know about, his name turned up on websites soliciting for sex, he had relationships with other women, etc., etc. But his family was adamant that he was not having any financial troubles, he had no affairs, and they firmly believe that his murder was the result of something to do with his career. Law enforcement think that his, I say murder, but his family believes that he was murdered. Law enforcement believe that his death had either something to do with a personal relationship that turned violent or that he killed himself. Now, the thing about this case is, like, most information is given by anonymous officials because federal government, right? And also because Jonathan's death remains unsolved and is an open case. In 2004, law enforcement told CNN that some investigators believed his wounds may have been self-inflicted because there were multiple hesitation wounds, like just superficial wounds that didn't really penetrate. And shortly after his body was found, investigators located a penknife near the area, and they believe that that was his knife, and it is the same knife that caused the wounds. But nobody has said anything about fingerprints or blood or anything like that. I'm going to link an article that I read in the show description because it's got a lot of really great detail. And you should read it because I need to get back to Ray. But Jonathan's case is certainly one that we need to review in the future. And the reason that I'm bringing it up is because many people speculate about the similarities between Jonathan's death or murder and Ray's disappearance because of the two men's lifestyles. You know, just the rumors of the womanizing and maybe money troubles and the laptops, you know, trying to maybe get stuff that people didn't want to be seen, or that they didn't want people to see, I should say, because I left a lot of things out that are just like people saying, oh, well, Ray probably had some child porn on his laptop, because there's that's just wild speculation. And of course, this entire episode has been founded in speculation because nobody knows what has happened. But there's nothing to say that that would even be remotely possible. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be possible, but because of the weird decision to not indict Jerry Sandusky when, you know, there was plenty of evidence to at least take another look, and then the fact that he bought the hardware, erasing software, all of that. So people like to kind of compare these two because it's very parallel, but in rumors, if that makes sense. In 2011, Ray's daughter did petition the courts to have Ray declared deceased, and it was granted. He has legally been declared dead. But the detective that I spoke of earlier that I can't remember how to say, it's like Reichard or Rickard or something, is, you know, like very open. We haven't forgotten. We're still trying to figure it out. So if you should have any information that would be helpful in any way, you can contact the Bellefonte Police Department, and I will put that information in the show description as well. And if you, you know, want to talk about this on social media, you can go to the Instagram, and I'll put, you know, some images there of Ray, because technically he is still missing, even though he has been declared dead. So, you know, You never know. But you can see those at Opine for True Crime on Instagram. If you want to send me any emails, you can send those to apinepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to show your appreciation, hopefully, in a quick, easy way, like I always say, Apple Podcast reviews are super helpful. And I did want to say that I read this review recently from Piper Maru to You, I think is how you say that. And I just wanted to say, Piper, if you're listening, or Piper Maru, if you're listening, or whatever your actual name is, thank you so much. It's mind-blowing to me when people leave like favorable reviews on a podcast that has interruptions by a cat or like the things that I talk about that really aren't even related. Like I don't know. I appreciate you for being kind is what I'm trying to say. And so I will leave you with that. And I hope to I have another little one that I'm going to try to get out by tomorrow. It is the Super Bowl. I don't care, but I do have to attend a party. So we'll see what happens. But as you have gathered, I am from Ohio and I did grow up in a Bengals household. It was kind of like a, you know, one time I made a Facebook post that compared it to the likeness of having an STD. Like, it's painful and you didn't ask for it, but like you have faith that it will clear up. And I waited all this time and it has in fact cleared up for my friends, because I stopped watching football in 2015. That is another conspiracy for a different episode, another day. Okay, bye.